for your intellectual amusement. We'll be doing Sutta 19 from the Digha Nikaya, a past life of Gotama. So what I'll do, I'll just move through quite slowly, and if anyone has any comment, as I move through each paragraph at a time, if you have any comments or views or opinions, just basically just raise a finger and we'll just stop and discuss it and then just move on from that point. Doesn't matter how trivial you think it is or how lofty, please. Don't be shy. So, thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying at Rajagaha on Vulture's Peak, and when the night was nearly over, Panchasika of the Gandhavas, lighting up the entire Vulture's Peak with a splendid radiance, approached the Lord, saluted him, stood to one side and said, Lord, I wish to report to you what I have personally seen and observed when I was in the presence of the 33 gods. Tell me then, Panchasika, said the Lord. So we have this reference here with at point 538 where Brahma disguises himself as Panchasika, who now appears in person, and previously he wore his head in this like a five knot or ringlet arrangement. Maybe it's a cultural custom, as he did when he was actually a younger boy. And this point 539, this radiance of the devas. So as some of you are already familiar with, the as you move up from the human realm into the Devaloka and the Brahma gods, that the more lofty the rebirth, the state of consciousness, the greater the actual, the luminosity and the radiance from the mind. So because the pure mind has a, in its natural state, it's so for example, the person who enters into to actually see that kind of thing, if you've got very, say, firm upachara samadhi, or even, say, for example, a person who's moving to the perimeter of upachara samadhi and actually has the samadhi nimitta coming up, you automatically see not in every case, the brightness of the mind. Many people have the brightness. Some people have the brightness and the pitisukha, and that radiance actually comes from the energy as the person develops the meditation and they gather the energy together, you know, as they're focusing with the samadhi practice and increasing the letting go, and they're unifying the mind, that energy it collects, and then it just increases, and you get this perception of say like light, radiance, energy increasing in the mind. And as you move up the realms, that radiance increases when they talk about, say, celestial beings, or the way when celestial beings encounter the Buddha, or say even human beings with they've got the psychic eye, the ability to see ghosts or spirits or devas, they, especially the devatas or above, they have that ability to see the radiance of the mind of that being. So, Lord, in earlier days, long ago, on the fast day of the 15th at the end of the rains, the 33 gods assembled and rejoiced that the Deva hosts were growing, like the Asura hosts declining, as in the reference to 18, verse 12, and then Saka uttered the verse. The gods of 33 rejoiced, their leaders too, praising the Tathagata and Dharma's truth. Seeing you come, Devas, fair and glorious, who've lived the holy life, now well reborn, outshining all the rest in fame and splendor, the mighty sages' pupils singled out. Seeing this, the 33 rejoiced, their leaders too, praising the Tathagata and Dharma's truth. So this reference here, I didn't actually check this point on 222, but The seeing new come Devas, fair and glorious, who've lived the holy life, so now well reborn. So when they use that kind of terminology, you know, you have the Eightfold Path, you have the Noble Eightfold Path, And as most of you understand, that the Noble Eightfold Path is specifically the wordings for people at the Aryan level who've already attained to Dhamma. So naturally, the Devas for example, a person who's a Sotapanna, the rebirth course is they're born a maximum. You know, you have three different types of Sotapannas, but they go to a maximum of seven lifetimes, between, say, celestial or the human realm because of the deep level of insight and the underlying purity of the mind. And those particular devas, because of they've got the attainment, you know, they've got that very deep and profound Dhamma attainment of the Aryans, that being reborn as an Aryan in the Devaloka, essentially you will be in the class of the most powerful in that level, in that world, that level of consciousness, just because of your, essentially because of your greater, your deeper underlying, say, spiritual mind development. At this, Lord, the 33 gods rejoiced the more, saying, the Deva hosts are growing, the Asura hosts are declining. Panchasika continued, then Saka, seeing their satisfaction, said to the 33 gods, would you like, gentlemen, to hear eight truthful statements in praise of the Lord? And on receiving their assent, he declared, what do you think, my lords of the 33, as regard the way in which the Lord has striven for the welfare of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare and happiness of devas and humans? And as, we can find no teacher endowed with such qualities, whether we consider the past or the present, other than the Lord. So this principle for the welfare and happiness of devas and humans. So naturally, you know, having contact with the beings who have contact with the Buddha are largely the human beings and the devatas or Brahma gods, because the beings in the lower worlds, you know, say from the hungry ghosts, the animals, the asuras, the hell beings, they're not in a position where they can actually be assisted or actually supported or helped to a greater degree, because, or actually even a significant degree, because of the I wouldn't call it low nature of the rebirth, but because they've actually dropped to quite a low level of consciousness, even with the Buddha's potential, or even possibly an arahant, they can't really help these beings to any great degree. There's only, say, one class of beings below the human realm, which will actually dependent on the merit of their friends, relatives, other human beings to help bring them up the scale, you know, within the rebirth process. But the beings of other classifications below the human realm, they can't really be assisted because of they're victims of their unwholesome karma. They're in states of deprivation and suffering that even the power of a Buddha, you know, can't really assist them to any great degree and alleviate the pain and the misery and the suffering they have. I wouldn't say it's impossible. You've got a situation where because of the heavy nature of the karma, which takes the person, the being, down so low, below the human realm, you just can't reverse that. It's not to say that the Buddha, you know, the Buddha, he certainly could have a mind to mind contact with a being. There's a range where he could assist them, but it's only up to a point where, you know, he could possibly communicate with beings in the lower realms and maybe give them some advice or instruction to a degree. There's not many references in the sutta with him actually having, say, formal discussion or, say, like mind-to-mind engagement with lower beings. But I would imagine it would be possible. But the thing is, because of the weighty nature of the karma, essentially those beings, they have to run the course and wait, you know, I mean, just they have to endure the hardships that they're being subjected to. And when that expires, then any preceding karma, depending on the power of the preceding wholesome karma, could possibly raise them up. This is incredibly complicated. You're looking at absolutely, you know, when you're looking at past lives, absolutely hundreds of thousands, much, much more than that, millions, millions of cause and effect forces at work. And there's no way in the world, even so, for example, an arahant in the current time, I mean, they could give you maybe a very general idea what could possibly, you know, if they've got very, very strong psychic abhinya, psychic power, they could give a person an approximate, a reasonably rough idea where that person's reborn, that maybe the length of the lifespan, but they couldn't pinpoint it, I mean, absolutely inexact terms. So, you know, I think the most the Buddha, you know, from when you study the suttas, the most the Buddha could do is maybe give some advice or maybe some mental, emotional support, but he basically can't override the power of the karma, which has taken that particular being down. You know, they spend incredible periods of time, you know, like hundreds of thousands. You know, if you're down in the deep hells, you know, you can be there for, you know, like the expansion and contraction of a universe. I mean, God, you know, billions of years. So, you know, it's not to be the power of that unwholesome karma is not to be underestimated. And when you read things in the suttas where the Buddha, you know, it almost sounds like scare tactics, you know, the way he spoke to beings about the dangers of being reborn in the hells and the type of karma that actually takes you down, you know, because in reality it's incredibly frightening, because once you're there, I mean, you know, you're not going to get out. We, you know, most beings are there for not just, it depends exactly on the mix, both of the karma that's actually taken there, the karma at the point of death, which has actually taken them down, but also the underlying wholesome karma, which has to come to fruition at some point, you know. So, you know, because it's so incredibly complicated, you know, eventually they will come up, and, you know, like who knows when type of thing. You know, that's why with the Buddha, you read some of the experiences in the hells and why he just was so, he warned people so sternly about the dangers of being, of going to a lower birth, because once you're in that state, you know, the ability that you don't have much ability or potential to really help yourself. You know, you may have to wait and endure for quite significant periods of time for the bad karma to become exhausted. You can affect the consciousness of our little family. You know, so for example, you've got somebody like Tom who's essentially he's training the kittens at the moment. You know, we've got the kitten gang, you've got three of them, plus mum and dad. They're all black cats, and he's almost got the kittens. You know, I mean, he's got them within touching distance. You can stroke them and pat them, and some of the kittens are stretching up, or, you know, even stretching up to jump on his lap and this type of thing. So it only took about 3 weeks where he could just run his hands right over the kittens and they wouldn't even bat an eye. But the mum and dad, you know, they're wild animals, and it could take a number of months to just draw them in. You know, you feed them at a distance And then slowly you bring them in, you bring them in and eventually you can get maybe a finger on them, then a hand, and then eventually you can start patting them and whatnot. But we had a wildcat years ago, and even 7-8 years later, I mean, the monks couldn't even put a finger on, couldn't get within even 4 feet. He was just completely, born in the forest, and just a wild animal. It couldn't be tamed. Eventually, he died. So probably the mother and father, they may have been dumped as kittens, and then they grew up in the forest. But the second offspring were it didn't take very long. But getting back to that original point, with Tom, feeding the kittens, stroking the kittens, they're already coming around. They're quite, they're not skittish. They're not concerned about people so much. Depending on not so much with the monks, but the visitors, they tend to run away. But if you can soften the minds of the kittens, if you can maybe increase the level of, say, friendliness in the mind, the level of trust and whatnot, because all like Tom's, because he's a very warm fellow and he's very touchy feely, he's always patting the kittens and stroking them and stuff like that. He's that kind of energy he's projecting at the kittens. It's going into their minds. It's softening the mind, affecting them in a reasonably good way. So the being in the monastery, where they've got it's a reasonably good energy compared to any other place outside the monastery boundary, where they're not really safe at all. People probably just shoot them or run over them, so you can affect the quality of the rebirth to a small degree, having contact with the visitors, with the monks, but just being on the receiving end of kindness, compassion, the sense of trust in human beings or whatnot. Those underlying qualities that were going to affect the minds of the kittens in a reasonably wholesome way. Potentially, it will support the consciousness to a degree. Like, we can't say how much. I can't really say that it would actually bring them up to the human realm. You've got to have incredibly strong psychic ability to know this kind of stuff. But it definitely would support, and there'd be no doubt whatsoever, the rebirth quality. For the happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare and happiness of devas and humans, we can find no teacher endowed with such qualities, whether we consider the past or the present, other than the Lord. So as most of you are familiar, the Buddha's spiritual paramita was maxed out to the limit. So when they talk about this business with the ten paramis, within the Mahayana, they've got six paramis within the Mahayana, but that ten paramis, that's a commentarial, introduction, so to speak. It's something that's been formulated within the commentarial material, but within the Buddha's personal development, those qualities are maxed out to the limit. You will get arahants who have those qualities to a degree, but naturally not to the same. Even though the arahant attainment is exactly the same, the spiritual qualities, the level of compassion, kindness, the wisdom faculty, it's different from one. So in the current age, from one arahant to another. But the Buddha has gone right to the maximum potential in those areas. The Lord has well explained what is right and what is wrong, what is blameworthy and what is blameless, what is to be followed and what is not to be followed, what is base and what is noble, what is foul, fair and mixed in quality. And we can find none who is a proclaimer of such things other than the Lord. Again, the Lord has well explained to his disciples the path leading to Nibbana, that being the middle path, what they call the Majjhima Patipada, and they coalesce Nibbana and the path, just as the waters of the Ganges and the Yamuna coalesce and flow on together. And we can find no proclaimer of the path leading to Nibbana other than the Lord. So as some of you are well aware, that there are no enlightened disciples in any tradition that you don't find the Eightfold Path. It's virtually no matter what people say or what tradition they come from, you cannot get enlightened unless you practice the Eightfold Path. You've got to have all those factors there. You've got to fulfill those factors to essentially a minimum, absolute, I'd say more like a medium range, medium to high range, in order to develop the very, very, the purity of mind, the depth of meditation and wisdom, which eventually lead to a point where those factors actually unify, and then the mind enters into the Nibbana element, and then that person realizes Ariyan Dhamma. And the Lord has gained companions, both learners, being at the first three levels of the Ariyan Dhamma, and those who, having lived the life, have abolished the corruptions, removed all the underlying defilements from the mind, and the Lord dwells together with them, all rejoicing in the one thing. And we can find no such teacher other than the Lord. The gifts given to the Lord are well bestowed, meaning that the person, essentially they maximize their personal merit by giving to someone of such incredibly high spiritual attainment. His fame is well established, so much so that I think the Katiyas will continue to be attached to him. Yet the Lord takes his food offerings without conceit, being without a sense of ego. The conceit is one of the last of the five higher fetters. These very refined defilements in the mind that a person needs to eliminate. And we can find no teacher who does this other than the Lord. And the Lord acts as he speaks, and he speaks as he acts. And we can find no teacher who does likewise in every detail of doctrine other than the Lord. So, there's also that other expression, say, perfect in conduct and resort. So, as most of you understand, that the internal states of mind completely match or in complete synchronization with the external behavior. Anything you see on the external level is matched completely. It's completely in tune with the inner state. Because you can have lay teachers, you can have monks and nuns who may look very nice and very pure and very well behaved and whatnot, but you can't actually see what goes on inside the mind. You can't see the underlying defilements in the mind of this person unless you've got very pronounced psychic ability, where you can actually see the radiance of that person's chitta on a regular basis. The Lord has transcended doubt, passed beyond all how and why, and has accomplished his aim in regard to his goal and the supreme holy life. And we can find no teacher who has done the like. whether we consider the past, the present, other than the Lord. And when Saka had thus proclaimed these eight truthful statements in praise of the Lord, the 33 gods were even more pleased, overjoyed, and filled with delight and happiness at what they had heard in the Lord's praise. Then certain gods exclaimed, "Oh, if only four fully enlightened Buddhas were to arise in the world and teach Dhamma just like the Blessed Lord, that would be for the benefit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans." And some said, "Never mind four fully enlightened Buddhas, three would suffice." And others said, "Never mind three, two would suffice." At this, Saka said, "It is impossible, gentlemen. It cannot happen that two fully enlightened Buddhas should arise simultaneous in a single world system. That cannot be." And as some of you are familiar, that's something that you see in the suttas. They never, ever, ever say that two Buddhas can arise together in one world system. "May this blessed Lord continue to live long for many years to come, free from sickness and death, disease. That would be for the benefit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world. It would be for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans." Then the 33 gods consulted and deliberated together about the matter concerning what they had assembled in the Sudama Hall, and the four great kings were advised and admonished on this matter as they stood by their seats unmoving. The kings instructed marked the words they spoke, standing calm, serene beside their seats. Then Brahma Sanukamara, having descended from his heaven and seeing their pleasure, uttered these verses. Then the 33 gods said to Brahma Sanukamara, "It is well, Brahma. We rejoice at what we have heard. Saka, Lord of the Devas, has also declared eight truthful statements to us about the Lord, at which we also rejoice." Then Brahma said to Saka, "It is well, Lord of the Devas, and we would like to hear those eight truthful statements about the Lord." "Very well, great Brahma," said Saka, and he repeated those eight statements. "What do you think, Lord Brahma?" And Brahma Sanukamara was pleased, overjoyed, and filled with delight and happiness at what he had heard in the Lord's praise. So some of you might be familiar with that kind of mind state with when we say, so for example, if we listen to a really say heartfelt Dharma talk, or maybe have an incredible meditation, or maybe some incredible amazing insight arises in the mind, you get the sense of incredible, this real strong sense of, say, joy and happiness actually rising up in the mind. So, you know, being a combination of, you know, say, you know, understanding, realization, like letting go, you know, the rapture, the delight in the understanding, the experience, maybe some wisdom that was imparted to you. And because in order for energy to actually rise up in the mind, you know, there needs to be, say, a minimum degree of understanding, and especially like letting go, and that's a major component of the path. As the wisdom faculty increases, the letting go should be very close to that level. It could be slightly behind, but you know, with these factors, the samadhi, wisdom, you know, one can be slightly ahead of the other, but it depends on the underlying potential of the person. Some people are they may find their samadhi is much faster than their wisdom faculty, because you've got the four different types with the path development: fast, slow, you know, hard and easy. So. Mm. So Brahma Sanukumara assumed a grosser form and appeared in the shape of Panchasika. And sitting there cross-legged, he said to the 33 gods, "For how long has the Blessed Lord been one of mighty wisdom?" Once upon a time, there was a king called Disampati. His chaplain was a Brahmin called the steward. So there's a reference here with this word Govinda, literally means like Lord of the herd, and it's in reference to being a title, which means say treasurer or steward. The king's son was a youth called Renu, and the steward's son was called Jyotipala. Prince Renu and Jyotipala, together with six other Katyas, formed a band of eight friends. In the course of time, the steward died, and King Disampati mourned him, saying, "Alas, at the very moment when we had entrusted all our responsibilities to the steward and were abandoning ourselves to the pleasures of the five senses, the steward had passed away." Hearing this, Prince Renu said, "Sire, do not mourn the steward's death overmuch. His son Jyotipala is cleverer than his father was and has a better eye for what is advantageous. You should let Jyotipala manage all the business you entrusted to his father." "Is that so, my boy?" "Yes, sire." Then the king called a man and said, "Come here, my good man. Go to the youth Jyotipala and say, 'May the Reverend Jyotipala be well. King Disampati sends for you. He would like to see you.'" "Very well, your majesty." And the man, said the man, and delivered the message. On receiving the message, Jyotipala said, "Very good, sir," and went to see the king. On entering the royal presence, he exchanged courtesies with the king, then sat down at one side. The king said, "We wish the Reverend Jyotipala to manage our affairs. Do not refuse. I will install you in your father's place and consecrate you as steward." "Very good," replied Jyotipala. So, for that point 549, consecrate being, say, being an office of royal rank, and so King Disampati appointed Jyotipala as steward in his father's place, and once installed, Jyotipala carried out the business his father had carried out, not doing any business his father had not done. He accomplished all the tasks his father had accomplished and no others. And people said, "This Brahmin is truly a steward. Indeed, he's a great steward." And that is how the young Brahmin Jyotipala came to be known as the great steward. And one day, the great steward went to the group of six nobles and said, "King Disampati is aged, decrepit, stricken with age. His life is near its end and he cannot last much longer. Who can tell how long people will live? When King Disampati dies, the king makers are bound to anoint Prince Renu as king. You should go, gentlemen, to Prince Renu and say, 'We are the beloved, dear, and favoured friends of the Lord Renu, sharing his joy and his sorrows. Our Lord King Disampati is aged. When he dies, the king makers are bound to anoint the Lord Renu as king. If the Lord Renu should gain the kingship, let him share it with us.'" "Very good, sir," said the six nobles, and they went to Prince Renu and spoke to him as the great steward had proposed. "Well, gentlemen, who, apart from myself, ought to prosper but you? If, gentlemen, I gain the kingship, I will share it with you." In due course, King Disampati died, and the kingmakers anointed Prince Renu king in his place. And having been made king, Renu abandoned himself to the pleasure of the five senses. Then the great steward went to the six nobles and said, "Gentlemen, now King Disampati is dead. The Lord Renu, who has been anointed in his place, has abandoned himself to the pleasure of the five senses. Who knows what will come of this? The sense pleasures are intoxicating. You should go to him and say, 'King Disampati is dead, and the Lord Renu has been anointed king. Do you remember your word, Lord?'" They did so, and the king said, "Gentlemen, I remember my word. Who is there who can divide this mighty realm?" This earth so broad in the north and so narrow, like the front of a cart. In the south, into seven equal parts. Who indeed, Lord, if not the great steward? So King Renu sent a man to the great steward to say, "My lord, the king sends for you." The man went, and the great steward came to the king, exchanged courtesies with him, and sat down to one side. Then the king said, "My lord, steward, go and divide this mighty realm of earth, so broad in the north and so narrow, like the front of a cart in the south, into seven equal parts." "Very good, sire," said the great steward, and he did so. And King Renu's country was in the center. So Dantapura to the Kalingas, Puttaka to the Asakas, Mahisati to the Awantis, Rakulu to the Sariras, Mithila to the Wetas, Kampas to the Angasa, go. Banaras to the Kasi, thus did the steward dispose. The six nobles were delighted with their respective gains and the success of their plan. What we wanted, desired, aimed, and strove for, we have got. It's quite interesting in the sense that just even with human beings, that, say, for example, when you look at the process of desire, a person can desire a particular object, say, for example, a material object in life. So the actual, that when you look at the mind experience, that the actual desire as it's flowing out towards its object, the object that it wishes to take possession of, there's always a degree of, say, discomfort and tension there. And then when the person secures the object of pursuit, then that desire is alleviated to quite a reasonable degree, and then that person feels a sense of say, like ease, maybe contentment, satisfaction. So you just see a change in the just a shift in the feeling state, and but that will only be the case that with that particular object, because anyone who watches, say, the way of desire moves in the mind, that it can just constantly shift and change. It can always find something, something new to play with, something to go after. Desire in itself, this is why the essentially it can't be, say, it can't be quenched through say satisfaction or the fulfillment of the desire, leads to, say, a temporary relief of that particular energy. But because desire is quite tricky, it keeps finding different objects to play with, different things to go after. That's the actual nature of desire. That's the way that particular energy works, and this is the reason why, even though it's not particularly, it makes perfect sense, but it's not particularly pleasant where people, and especially with the practitioners and the monastics, that we just slowly have to sort of whittle away desire, just slowly over time, because that's where the problem is. That's where a source of discomfort and suffering, because the more you eliminate desire in the mind, the more contentment, the more the peace, the more real sort of happiness you have. Then the six nobles came to the great steward and said, "Reverend steward, just as you were a beloved dear and faithful friend to King Renu, so you have been to us. Please manage our affairs for us. We trust you will not refuse." So he administered the realms of seven anointed kings. Being the administrator. And he also taught the mantras to 7 distinguished Brahmins and 700 advanced pupils. In course of time, good reports were spread about concerning the great steward. The great steward can see Brahma with his own eyes, talk with him face to face and consult with him. And he thought, now this good report is being spread about concerning me, that I can see Brahma with my own eyes. But it is not true. However, I have heard it said by aged and respected Brahmins, the teacher of teachers, that anyone who withdraws into meditation for the 4 months of the rains, develops the absorption on compassion, can see Brahma with his own eyes, talk with him face to face and consult with him. Suppose I were to do this. So there's also this this reference. I'm not sure exactly where the I've actually seen this in meditation manuals where they talk about the four Brahma Viharas, and actually when you develop limitless loving kindness, it gives you access to the first jhana, limitless compassion, access to the second, limitless sympathetic joy. You know, that's the point of unification of mind, and limitless equanimity will take you through to the fourth jhana. So, and there is, there's some slight correlations there. You know, there's no doubt whatsoever the way, say, a jhana teacher will tell you that equanimity is very strong in the fourth jhana. You know, you're looking at, when your jhana factors, you're looking at this pure equanimity and unification of mind. You know, you're looking at two factors. And as you move down the jhanas to 3, 2, 1, because the mind is becoming, it's not as refined. I mean, it's still incredibly refined, but not as much. Then so for example, the highest level of happiness you will see is in the third jhana, the Piti Sukha is at its highest level, and then the level of happiness that decreases as you move down from the second to the first. It's a even though it's very refined, it's still a coarser level of happiness and bliss. And it's all just like just wordplay, but for the people who can actually do those states, as they refine the mental factors and they move from the first to the second, the third, the fourth, it's incredibly clear, very, very clear to them that, you know, when they attain a second jhana, that the first jhana is quite coarse. But for regular meditators, if they had the first jhana, they would probably consider it to be the greatest thing that ever happened in their life. And I even heard the comment of one person in Melbourne who was quite a wealthy fellow, and he said he said off the cuff he would give $1 million if he was able to get back to first jhana and actually sit in that state for a couple of hours. He said he was prepared to give $1 million to experience that again. So I didn't have any doubt the way he explained it. I didn't go into fine detail, but it sounded like a genuine state. But even though he's quite a busy person, he had very strong potential for the samadhi practice. But when Long Po Tui came from Thailand, I was talking with him about his meditation, and Long Po Tui has got reasonably strong psychic ability. You might have been able to see the last, possibly easily the last one or two lifetimes. Probably knew how many lives he had on the path within the last 5 possibly. And he just said to him point blank, and Long Po Tui has been considered to be an arahant for a long time within the forest tradition, and he said, categorically, that that particular person he would attain to Sotapanna within 7 lifetimes. He said, it was absolutely sure. If he kept developing the path as he was, it was guaranteed, because his personal development was you know, just not on the average level. It was already at the intermediate level as a lay practitioner. Okay, so point 39. So the great steward went to King Renu and told him of the report. And of his wish to go into retreat and develop the absorption on compassion, and nobody is to come near me except to bring me food. Reverend steward, do as you think fit. The six nobles likewise replied, Reverend steward, do as you think fit. He went to the seven Brahmins and the 700 pupils and told them of his intentions, adding, so gentlemen, you carry on with reciting the mantras you have heard and learned and teach them to each other. Reverend steward, do as you think fit. They replied. Then he went to his 40 equal ranking wives and they said, Reverend steward, do as you think fit. So the great steward erected a new lodging to the east of the city and withdrew there for the 4 months of the rains, developing the absorption on compassion. And nobody came near him except to bring him food. But at the end of 4 months, he felt nothing but dissatisfaction and weariness. As he thought, I heard it said that anyone who withdraws into meditation for the 4 months of the rains, developing the absorption on compassion, can see Brahma with his own eyes. But I cannot see Brahma with my own eyes and cannot talk, discuss or consult with him. So realistically, you know, it's a similar principle. You know, if you're aiming for, say, mind-to-mind contact with our high beings, either devas or Brahma gods, you know, you've got to have at least firm upachara samadhi, first jhana, for that kind of, kind of mind power, mind potential. And, you know, when I asked Tongpo Pier quite a number of years ago, how do you practice psychic power? Essentially what he said was through the power of intention. He said, all I have to do is to direct my mind to say a time and place, to a particular world, or if I want to know or understand anything in particular. And he said, just through the power of intention, that my mind's awareness either arises at that place, whether it's, you know, he projects his mind into another world, or he has, say, like visions arising from samadhi, either a state of samadhi or in a state of investigation. So what he seeks with the power of his intention actually arises either in the mind's eye, or he projects the consciousness out of the body in time and space. Mm-hmm. Now Brahma Sanan Kumara read his thoughts, and as swiftly as a strong man might stretch out his flexed arm or flex it again, he disappeared from the Brahma world and appeared before the great steward, and the great steward felt fear and trembling, and his hair stood on end at such a sight as he had never seen before. And thus fearful, trembling, with hair standing on end, he addressed Brahma Sanan Kumara in these verses. O splendid vision, glorious and divine, who are you, Lord? I fain would know your name. In highest heaven I am known by all. Brahma Sanan Kumara knows me thus. A seat and water for the feet and cakes are fitting for a Brahma. Let the Lord decide what hospitality he would. We accept the gifts that's offered. Now declare what it is you wish for from us, a boon of profit in this very life or in the next. Say, Lord steward, what it is you'd have. Then the great steward thought, Brahma Sanan Kumara offers me a boon. What shall I choose? Benefits in this life or in that to come? Then he thought, I am an expert in matters of advantage in this life, and others consult me about this. Suppose I were to ask Brahma Sanan Kumara for something of benefit in the life to come. And he addressed Brahma in these verses. I asked Brahma Sanan Kumara this, doubting Him who has no doubts I ask, for others too I ask. By doing what can mortals reach the deathless Brahma world? That man who spurns all possessive thoughts, alone intent, compassion filled, aloof from stench, free from lust, established thus and training thus, can mortals reach the deathless Brahma world? So with this business, can mortals reach the deathless Brahma world? So this principle of the deathless, say, realization of Brahma, you know, when the pre-Buddhist practitioners, within the times of the Vedas, formulation and practice of the Vedic tradition, and the early Brahmin caste, they believe that the highest attainment one could realization that a human being could attain was, say, unification of Brahma, because they had this belief that Brahma was the creator, the maker of the universe, of mortal beings, of all, you know, creation of everything which can be seen and be known, the all powerful, and the deathless, you know, when you're talking about deathless in reality terms, you know, I mean, realistically, you're talking about, you know, the realization of Nibbana, you know, being the deathless element. But if you're talking about deathlessness in its highest form, it's got to be at the level of an arahant who has completely severed the cycle of birth and death. You know, so for example, someone at the third level, the Anagami, will still be reborn in the Sudawasa, in the five higher abodes, which are the dwelling places of Anagamis, and then they pass away into, once the wholesome, the incredibly wholesome karma which has actually brought them to that state expires, they realize full nibbana, and the mind element becomes extinguished. The actual elements which make up the mental continuum, they dissolve, those forces, those energies within the consciousness, the four khandhas in that world, they just disband, and then that being is completely dissolved. That man who spurns all possessive thoughts, alone, intent, compassion-filled, aloof from stench, free from lust, established thus and training thus, can mortals reach the deathless Brahma world? I understand spurning possessive thoughts, this means that one renounces one's possessions, small or great, leaves one's relatives, few or many, and shaving off hair and beard, goes forth from the household life into homelessness. So, for some of you who've read some of the early books with the... Actually, this point came up with Longpo Tui. Well, there's one of the early, the forest masters, one of Achan Umpo Man's first generation disciples. I mean, it took him, you know, he was a true forest practitioner, just living, you know, just essentially just living under a tree, living incredibly simply, you know, in the forest, you know, for long periods of time alone. And, but even then, it took him like 12 solid years of practice, and it's not just playing around, you know, this is like absolute minimum, you know, 6 to 10 hours every single day for 12 years before he attained to first jhana, before he actually unified his mind. And but I imagine the meditation would have been quite firm after that point, when you've got that kind of foundation behind you. So as long as you can maintain that level of meditation, you know exactly what you're doing with the vipassana, as I mentioned before, with references from the teachers in Thailand. You know, I mean, you can attain to Sotapanna within, I mean, 5 to 10 years. It's a realistic possibility, but it's not like playing around. It's, you absolutely full commitment, 100%. Spurning possessive thoughts. I understand alone intent. That means that one goes off on one's own and chooses a lodging in the forest or at the foot of a tree or in a mountain glen, in a rocky cave, a charnel ground, in the jungle or on a heap of grass in the open. And it's exactly what the Buddha said. You know, it's in the modern age, even in Asia, you know, you basically, if you really want to live alone, you've got to go way out. You really need to be about, I mean, absolute minimum, like 1 to 1.5 hours walking distance from the nearest village. You know, you don't even want to be. I mean, 1 hour would be the absolute as close as you'd want to be. If you really want seclusion and you basically don't want anyone coming around and maybe chit-chatting and maybe wanting to have a cup of tea or something like that. Then Achan Jyoti Dhamma, who's on the southwest coast in Sri Lanka, he's been living alone up on a mountaintop for several years now. I think he comes down maybe once every 4 to 6 weeks and he does the Padimokkha at one of the local forest monasteries. And but the thing is, you know, he's like living with wild animals. You know, he comes across, you know, he comes in contact with elephants and wild cats, you know, panthers, and they've got, you know, I think they've got small bears. There's a small species of bear, I think, in Sri Lanka, and snakes and whatnot. Yeah, I mean, realistically, that's what it takes. You know, for people who are really, really aiming, you know, you've got to be prepared to put your life on the line. I already mentioned this point before, but realistically, that's what it takes. If you really want to get enlightened, you have to do it like that, and you've got to be prepared to put your life on the line, and you know. Deal with sickness and wild animals and going hungry and whatnot. You know, you're prepared to put yourself through that. I understand compassion filled. That means that one dwells suffusing one quarter with mind filled with compassion, then a second, then a third and a fourth quarter. Thus one abides suffusing the whole world up and across, everywhere, all around, with a mind filled with compassion, expanded, immeasurable, free from hatred and ill will. This is how I understand compassion filled. But the Lord's words about aloof from stench I do not understand. What do you mean, Brahma, by stench among men? Pray lighten my ignorance, O wise one, on this. What hindrance causes man to stink and fester? Heading for hell from Brahma's realm, cut off. Anger, lying, fraud and cheating, avarice, pride and jealousy, coveting, doubt and harming others, greed and hate, stupor and delusion, the loathsome stench that these give off heads man for hell from Brahma realms cut off. As I understand the Lord's words about the stench, these things are not easy to overcome if one lives the household life. I will therefore go forth from the household life into the homeless state. Reverend Stewart, do as you think fit. You know, because especially with many of the lay practitioners, you've got a very solid practice. You know, within their own parameters, they may be doing the best of, maybe working their practice to the best of their ability, but they're essentially compromised by the by sensory material coming in from the outside, maybe inside their own mind. Of, you know, they've got a regular practice. They work their foundation principles to the best of their ability. But you have to work in this world, go shopping, deal with people, this and that. You've got all this stuff coming in through the five senses, which essentially can corrupt you, and it's going to slow your practice down. So that, you know, that principle of stench doesn't necessarily mean it comes from within the person. You know, the person could be quite high-minded, but you know, they have to deal and live, you know, within this society. So the great steward went to King Renu and said, "My lord, please appoint another minister to manage your affairs. I wish to go forth from the household life into homelessness. After what Brahma has told me about the stench of the world, which cannot easily be overcome by one living the household life, I am going forth into homelessness. King Renu, lord of this realm, I declare, you yourself must rule. I counsel you no more. If anything you lack, I'll make it good. If any hurt you, my royal arms shall guard you. You, my father, I, your son, steward, stay. I lack nothing. None there is who harm me. No human voice I heard at home. I cannot stay. None human, what he'd like who calls that you at once abandon home and all of us." There was even a point, even with people who've read the life story of, from what Pong Longpo Liam, and when he went off and ordained, he didn't reconnect with his family. It was for years, and I think it was well over 10, maybe 15 years. It's been about 5-6 years since I've seen the reference, but it was an incredibly long time. And some of his family who were as he was moving on to Dong, he was moving through a particular village, and his own sister and another relative, they didn't even recognize him. He'd been away from home. He was a 17, 18 year old teenager when he left, and then when they saw him again, he was at least late 20s, 30s, and they didn't even recognize him. "Before I went on this retreat, I thought of sacrifice, lighting the sacred fire, strewing kusa grass. But now, eternal Brahma from Brahma's realm appeared. I asked, he answered, I can now stay no more. Reverend steward, in your words, I trust such words. Once heard, you had no other course. We will follow, steward, be our master like a beryl gem, clear of finest water, so purified. We'll follow in your wake. If the reverend steward goes forth from the household life into homelessness, I will do the same. Wherever you go, we will follow." Then the great steward went to the six nobles and said to them, "My lords, please appoint..." Then the great steward went to the six nobles and said to them, "My lords, please appoint another minister to manage your affairs. I wish to go forth from the house of life and the homelessness." And the six nobles went aside and consulted together. "These Brahmins are greedy for money. Perhaps we can win the great steward round with money." So they came back to him and said, "Sir, there is plenty of wealth in these seven kingdoms. Take as much as you like." "Enough, gentlemen. I have received plenty of wealth from my lords already. That is the very thing I am renouncing in order to go forth from the household life into homelessness, as I have explained." Then the six nobles went aside again and consulted together. "These Brahmins are greedy for women. Perhaps we can win the great steward round with women." So they came to him and said, "Sir, there are plenty of women in these seven kingdoms. Take your pick." "Enough, gentlemen. I already have 40 equal wives, and I'm leaving them in order to go forth from the household life into homelessness, as I have explained. If the reverend steward goes forth from the household life into homelessness, we will do likewise. Wherever you go, we will follow. If you renounce those lusts that bind most men, exert yourself, be strong, and patiently endure." And that's exactly what Longpo Cha said. He had, that was years ago, he had a young monk who, I think he had about 5 reins, and he was on the edge, he was quite shaky, and close to disrobing, and he said to Longpo Cha, I don't think I can last, Longpo, it's just too difficult. And Longpo Cha just turned around and said, he said something like, it's not that difficult. He said it's easy. He said, all you have to do is endure. And it's a reality principle, you know. If you've got quite a significant degree of patient endurance and you know how to work with your defilements, especially the monastics, they've got to pay very close attention to this. And, you can survive in the long run 20, 30, 40 years, but you've got to, with the underlying energies in the mind, you've got to keep the finger on them constantly, especially greed. And to give you an idea, so for example, I heard one of the Kuru Brahmacharis said to a junior monk, I mean, just point blank, he said something like, he said if you have a problem with hatred and anger, he said you will still be able to survive in the monk's life. But if you have a problem with the sensuality, especially in relation with females, he said you won't last. He said you're gone. Exert yourself, be strong and patiently endure. So you're looking at a degree of emotional strength to a degree, but the key principle, you've got to know how to work with your defilements, because even with the senior monks who've left, and this is no criticism of them in any way, because people, until you've actually been in robes for 30 years, there's absolutely no way that you can know or understand how that person feels when they leave. Absolutely no way you can understand that kind of mind state. But let's see, I lost my train of thought. But it's that principle, because with the monastics, it's always, whatever, say like 99% of the time, it's always the defilements which take people out. That's what takes people out of, say, the monastic form. And this is why, even with the Kuru Brahmacharis, why they put this emphasis, they all over and over and over again with the body contemplation practices, and the Buddha laid this one down for the novices when they ordain, the contemplation of the five kamatanas, the head, hair, body, hair, nail, teeth, skin, because you've only got to work those to an incredibly small degree. Even incredibly simple mantra formulations, things like, bones are composed of earth element. You can even experiment with this kind of stuff yourself. Single mantra, if you ever see strong greed or lust arise in the mind, use that kind of mantra formulation. You can cool the mind off in 1, 2, 3 minutes without any major problem. So even that kind of very, very light, very, very light kind of body reflection is enough to keep excessive desire and greed in check. And if that desire can't be arrested, then you just put the pressure on and you really get into it. And then, you go for a body part, you go for the things that you really like, and then you really get into it. Start investigating and taking it apart, anicca-dukkha anatta. And if that fails, then you go to death. You have four levels of meditation. The way the Buddha explained, you start with anapanasati. If you're not successful working anapanasati to the best of your ability, then you add metta, which increases the energy, the softness, the positivity of the mind, increases the inner joy. Because people have got to have a minimum level of happiness to actually develop samadhi. As the Buddha said, it's the happy mind which becomes concentrated or unified. And if you still can't get it together, then you slowly bring in the body practices. But then again, you've got to be quite careful, because they're very, very strong medicine. And they're very forceful, and they put a lot of pressure on these underlying defilements, especially the greed and lust, and it can stir up quite a bit of trouble if you're not careful. And if you still can't get good results with the body practices, then you go to death, because death is the final, is the final level. Death negates all states, brings all states to an end, except naturally the full rebirth process in samsara temporarily. But people find that if they just can't stop the mind, if it just will not shut up after they've used the first three tools, and they've got to use the heavy duty applications. And so Lord Steward, just wait 7 years and then we too will go into homelessness. Whenever you go, we will follow. Gentlemen, 7 years is far too long. I cannot wait for 7 years. Who can tell how long people will live? We have to go on into the next world. We must learn by means of wisdom. We must do what is right and live the holy life, for nothing that is born is immortal. Now I am going forth as I have explained. Well, Reverend Steward, just wait 6 years, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then we will go forth into homelessness. Wherever you go, we will follow. Gentlemen, 1 year is far too long. Then wait 7 months. Gentlemen, 7 months is too long. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, half a month is far too long. Then, Reverend Steward, just wait 7 days while we make over our kingdoms to our sons and brothers. At the end of 7 days, we will go forth into homelessness. Wherever you go, we will follow. 7 is not long, gentlemen. I agree, my lords, to 7 days. Then the great steward went to the 7 Brahmins and their 700 advanced pupils and said to them, "Now, your reverences, you must seek another teacher to teach you the mantras. I mean to go forth from the household life into homelessness after what Brahma has told me about the censure of the world, which cannot be easily overcome by one living the household life. I am going forth into homelessness. Reverend Steward, do not do so. There is little power and profit in the homeless life, and much power and profit in the life of a Brahmin." "Do not say such things, gentlemen. Besides, who has greater power and profit than I have? I have been like a king to kings, like Brahma to the Brahmins, like a deity to householders, and I am giving up all this in order to go forth from the house for life into homelessness. As I have explained, if the Reverend Steward goes forth from the house for life into homelessness, we will do likewise. Wherever you go, we will follow." It was an interesting point. One of the lay disciples thought that even with the monastics, that for example, if somebody had upachara samadhi, that it wouldn't be enough to stop that person disrobing. But I mean, there wouldn't be any doubt in my mind whatsoever. I mean, if you've got a monastic who can even do the samadhi nimitta on a regular basis, I just can't see why that person would disrobe, because of it's not only the inner happiness, but it's the insight into the mind, even at that level, the way the mind works, and quite reasonable insights which come from that that intermediate stage. So, but the thing, there was a point that with any of the senior monks that we've lost, not sort of harping on this too much, but it's just a point of thought which come up, that essentially it's because of the weak point, the weak link in the chain will always be the samadhi. You can get very very good teachers, very good dharma teachers, monks. It's usually the monks, not so much the nuns so much. And the weakest link in the chain will always be the samadhi practice. They can have all the other foundation principles. Person can sound very, very impressive, can give great Dharma talks, come up with incredible insights, and be very beautiful in form and speech and all the rest of it. But the samadhi, with all the even really good monks that have left with 20, 25, 30 plus reigns, the samadhi was always the weakest link in the chain. But in every other area, the quality of the practice was quite good. Point 57. Then the great steward went to his 40 equal wives and said, "Whichever of you ladies wishes to may go back to her own family and seek another husband. I mean to go forth into homelessness. You alone are the kinsman we could wish for, the only husband we want. If the reverend steward goes forth into homelessness, we will do likewise. Wherever you go, we will follow." And so the great steward, at the end of the 7 days, shaved off his hair and beard, donned yellow robes, and went forth from the house of life into homelessness. And with him went the 7 anointed Kshatriya kings, the 7 wealthy and distinguished Brahmins with their 700 advanced pupils, his 40 equal wives, several thousand Kshatriyas, several thousand Brahmins, several thousand householders, even some harem ladies. It's a pretty incredible bunch. And so, followed by this company, like a small army, the great steward wandered through villages, towns, and royal cities, and whenever he came to a village or town, he was like a king to kings, Brahma to the Brahmins, like a deity to householders. And in those days, wherever anyone sneezed or stumbled, they used to say, "Praise to be the great steward, praise to be the minister of 7. And the great steward dwelt, suffusing one quarter with a mind filled with loving kindness, then a second, then a third, and a fourth quarter. He dwelt, suffusing the whole world up and down, across, everywhere, all around, with a mind filled with compassion, with a mind filled with sympathetic joy, equanimity, free from hatred and ill will. And thus he taught his disciples the way to union with the Brahma world, and naturally that union will only be temporary, whether you do it as a human being, or even if you die with a mastery of the first jhana, realistically, that you know you can arise. Say either in the now, if you're looking at a minimum degree of mastery with the first jhana, you arise within the retinue of Brahma. An intermediate mastery of first jhana, you know, this is at death of the human being, arising in the circle of Brahma's ministers. And then when you have full mastery of the first jhana and you die with that attainment, you know, this is complete, this is mastery, like every single day, you can do it every single day, right to the point you die, where you've got the hindrances are suppressed, and you die in that mind, with that mind state. To give you an idea, a person, mentioned to me by a very good Samadhi teacher, and he said that, so, for example, if a person sits in, say, second jhana for at least 2 to 3 hours, when they come out of that state, you don't see the 5 hindrances for 48 hours. So the suppression effect is really, really strong. Okay, and all down to point 60, and all those who had at that time been the great stewards, pupils, and have fully mastered his teaching, were after death, at the breaking up of the body, reborn in a happy sphere in the Brahma world. And those who had not fully mastered his teachings were reborn either among the Paranimitta Vasati Devas, the Nimitta Narati Devas, among the Tusita, Yama, the Devas of the 33 gods, or the Devas of the 4 great kings, and the very lowest realm that any of them attained was that of the Gandhavas. Celestial Gandhavas, celestial musicians, is one understanding. Thus, the going forth of all those people was not fruitless or barren, but productive of fruit and profit. Do you remember? And yeah, it's also good. If a person has very incredible meditation and they die from the human realm, it's a really good idea to make your intention very, very strong. I mean, every single day that you want to continue with your practice of Dharma, you know, as soon as you arise in that world, that, you know, your attention is well established and you continue to practice, you know, you continue to develop, you know, your mind with the Eightfold Path, you know, because some people, if they, So, for example, if they arise in Deva Loka, it's possible just to get completely lost in the, to lose one's mind in the celestial pleasures, and then one can waste a lot of time when one eventually falls from that state. Do you remember this, Lord? I do, Panchasika. At that time, I was the Brahman, the great steward, and I taught those disciples the path to union with the Brahma world. However, Panchasika, that holy life does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to super-knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to birth in the Brahma world, whereas my holy life leads unfailingly to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, super-knowledge, enlightenment, nibbana. That is the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So all eight factors. And Panchasika, those of my disciples who have fully mastered my teaching have, by their own super knowledge, realized, by the destruction of the corruptions, the underlying defilements in this very life, the uncorrupted freedom of heart and mind. You know, so we're talking about full purification, uncorrupted freedom of heart and mind. And of those who have not fully mastered it, some by the destruction of the five lower fetters will be reborn spontaneously, attaining thence to Nibbana without returning to this world, so they don't drop below the level of the Anagami, rebirth in the Sudawasa, the five five worlds for the people who die as Anagamis. Without being reborn spontaneously, attaining thence to Nibbana without returning to this world, either human or celestial, being, say, like Deva, human or Deva worlds, some by the destruction of the three fetters and the reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion will become once returners, being Sakadagamis, and they say with the Sakadagamis, one to two lifetimes maximum. Within say human and celestial worlds. Let me get that right. I think it's 2 to 3. It's been a long time since I've read it over. I think it's a maximum of 2 to 3 as a Sakadagami. Even if they put their feet up and they did no spiritual work whatsoever, that karma, would become completely exhausted in 3 lifetimes. I'm pretty sure it's 2 to 3. And for the Sotapanna, you've got the 3 types of Sotapannas, one with a maximum of 7, one with a maximum of 2 to 3, and one with one rebirth at most. And you know, it's quite possible if you're a Sotapanna and you really, realistically, if you really put forth effort, you know, almost without any doubt, you should, you know, if you've got even like 5 years, I'd say more like, you know, from what the Kruvrachans have said, I'd say 10 years, most people have been able to wrap up their spiritual work within 10 years and go right through to Arahata. Once returners who will return. Let me get this right. Let me correct myself here. Destruction of the three fetters and the reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion will become once returners. I'm a bit of slightly confused here. Who will return once more to this world before making an end of suffering. It could be either the human world, it could be human or the Devaloka, and some by the destruction of three fetters will become stream winners. Yeah, I got confused there with one of the Sotapanna classifications. Will become stream winners, incapable of falling into states of woe, assured of enlightenment. Thus, the going forth of all these people was not fruitless or barren, but productive of fruit and profit. And I've never heard of a Sotapanna who was actually born in the human world in very impoverished conditions. They had minimum conditions for to develop themselves. They didn't have like physical deformities or any kind of mental limitations. Or incredibly, like bad family backgrounds. They had minimum supporting conditions to move forward, and eventually, if they weren't actually practicing with the path right at that point, they would do because of the underlying karma. Because of the profundity of the attainment, the depth of the insight knowledge, the strength of the meditation, that person, they have to reconnect with the path. They usually do at a young age. You usually see it. I mean, not even late teens. It's usually very early, 15, 16. It's an age, even younger than that. But it seems to be a common age where they get really quite strongly established, 15, 16, maybe 17 possibly. And the young person, they go to the monastery, they're practicing every meditation every day, developing themselves. Stream is incapable of forming states of assured of enlightenment. Thus the going forth of all these people was not fruitless or barren, but productive of fruit and profit. Thus the Lord spoke, and Panchasika of the Gandhavas was delighted and rejoiced at the Lord's word, and having saluted him, he passed him by on his right and vanished from the spot. So did anyone have anything incredible to bring up? Yeah, John? Oh, you got some stuff. Oh, okay. And sorry, John, you were saying? No, go ahead.
What was said today seems to be a bit of contradictory to what's in the middle length discourse. It said that Jodipada was actually trained under the Buddha Kassapa for a period of time. So it doesn't seem to match up here.
Yeah, so as far as the storyline, the narrative, I'd have to look into it myself. I didn't actually cross check with the Majjhima, but I'll check with Achyam Brahmi. I'll check with Achyam Brahmi, so that cross check. And the next time I see, I'll let you know. I mean, Brahmi's done a lot of studies with the suttas, so I wouldn't be surprised if he's got something interesting to come up with. Right. Yeah, I'll check it out when I get back. So, was there any more questions from the audience? Okay, so we have got question one from Frida, Sydney. Does someone with some sort of intellectual disability have to be reborn without the disability and live as a human being, or can they go to a higher state if they live a good life? So, two components. Does someone with some sort of intellectual disability have to be reborn without the disability and live as a human being, or can they go to a higher state if they live a good life? So, I know people with intellectual limitations who definitely have enough inner intelligence to practice the path. You can be a very, very simple person, even a simple simpleton on the classification of an intellectual classification, and that person can still understand how to practice his path. You don't have to be a brain surgeon whatsoever, and that person could definitely practice maybe the vipassana. Not to say that they could certainly get, they could, I would imagine, you know, like I've met people with intellectual limitations and intellectual challenges, and some won't, they won't be able to really develop the maybe the vipassana to a deep level just because of the nature of their intellect, but some people certainly could. It's very much a personal thing. Or can they go to a higher state if they live a good life? Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. So even a person with intellectual challenges, you know, if they accord with principles of Dhamma, they practice the path and they develop the foundation principles, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that would support them. And depending on the past karma, the quality of the karma in the current life, you know, that's going to usually, you know, it would take them up in the planes of rebirth. And so it's quite possible, and especially with that kind of development, you can almost guarantee that when that person's reborn, that they will not have that intellectual affliction. So, for example, you get a person even with physical disabilities, even physical intellectual disabilities, who's able to develop the path as a human being. When they die, just because of the power of the underlying, you know, the wholesome states of developing, the power of the good karma, you will find that will override any kind of residual karma from that current life. You know, the karma, the wholesome karma they're actually generating now will essentially overpower or negate any residual karma which actually brought them to the disability state in the current life. Now, if you're looking at like 10, 20, 30 years, it's incredible. It's an incredible level of practice. Okay, question two from Feeder in Sydney. Are mind states such as the hell realms actually realms, or are they just mind states a human experiences? Well, there's a couple of interpretations on this one. I've heard senior teachers say that the person's consciousness is actually sent to and arises in that state, that lower state, or the person, they actually create that state within their own mind, or they arise in a particular, say, they could arise as a hell being in a particular state and place, you know, because you can never have a number of hell realms at different levels, like different times and space. You know, it's not just you know, just one plane. You know, depending on the rebirth, you know, you're looking at like different worlds or different spheres or different planes within, so different world systems. But the common principle is, you know, they say that the person's mind arises in that world as if sent there. And so, you know, I mean, it's hard to say for somebody who's actually possibly actually been reborn in hell for a very, very short period of time, like several days, and then they rise back up to the human world, and they've got a very firm memory. You know, that's the kind of person who could say from experience exactly what happened to the state of consciousness. You know, for me, it's just, you know, I read the suttas, but it's essentially guesswork. But for someone who's actually descended into a hell realm, or has psychic abhinya and can project the mind into that world and understands the process moving in to that world and returning, they're the only people who can really grasp that type of transition. Question three from Rudita in Latvia. Dear Acharya, what actions lead to rebirth in animal and hell realms? If I live a good life now, can I still be reborn in animal hell realms because of bad karma from my previous lives? So, what actions lead to rebirth in animal and hell realms? So, as many of you are familiar with, the basis of those actions which take you down in the lower worlds, specifically animal and hell realms, is say with a sort of rendering unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind. And there's like 10 courses of actions, 10 unwholesome courses of actions which lead to the generation of bad karma, which take the person down the scale. And it's just the classic in relation with mind-body development, just the classic principles of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, breaking all the precepts, any kind of, say, unwholesome behavior which gives rise to bad results. If you want to know if a particular mode of behavior is good or bad, if that mode of behavior gives rise to bad results, in a general sense, then you know it's unskillful. It's the kind of bad karma which is essentially it's going to weigh on you and it's going to take you down if you don't essentially balance the scales and generate enough positive karma to protect yourself, to counteract, to balance out, and or suppress or just completely override and just completely smother it so it doesn't even reach you. There's different principles at work. It's very, very complex, but it is possible. If you develop a lot of wholesome karma in this life, you can stop many different types of karma even actually reaching you. You can either block them, you can suppress them, you can block them. They can reach you to a very, very small degree, maybe just like an inkling, even for incredibly short periods of time. Or you can basically you can stop them, stop it like dead in its tracks. It just can't touch you while you have that personal level of development, that personal level of wholesome development. It just can't reach you. And if I live a good life now, can I still be reborn in an animal hell realm because of bad karma from my previous lives? I really doubt it. From what I've heard, seen enlightened teachers say previously, little comments like, if a person has been, say, practicing, say for example, specifically as a lay practitioner, if you've been practicing for 5 years minimum, you're in a really incredibly, safe position. Not to say that I know, but from what I've heard senior teachers say, I just can't see that person actually dropping below the human realm. Even if that person had some bad karma behind them, the remote possibility they could be reborn as a human being, maybe in poor circumstances. But I couldn't imagine that person is going to be afflicted, sick, diseased, even to a mild degree. Because if you're practicing, all of you can feel it. You're practicing Dhamma for 5 years, and so it's a long period of time. As far as the human world is concerned, and you should be in a very safe position as far as the rebirth process. But when you say, for example, when you arise, when you take rebirth following that life, you've got to sustain the path. You've got to maximize the mind body development and essentially you've got to protect yourself from bad karmic forces which are they're deeper down in the mind, and it's just a matter of time before they bear fruit. So you've got to keep developing wholesome states continually, not just practice for 5 years and then just drop it. for 3 months, 6 months, and then get back to it. You know, you've got to do it constantly if you want maximum security, maximum protection as far as this life, as far as future lives. You've got to keep it going continually, you know, on a daily basis, even to a small degree, even to, you know, you've only got 5 minutes, you just sit in meditation for 5 minutes, or you read a sutta, or you know, maybe read a Dhamma book or something like that. You know, at least one, you know, you develop one foundation principle on a daily basis for 5 minutes, and you never let it slide, you know, constantly, day after day after day. They are the people who go far in the long term when you're looking at a succession of lives, you know, this kind of hit and miss affair, you know, practicing and then dropping it and then starting to practice again. It just doesn't bear fruit in the long term. It's the sustained effort with Dhamma principles, which really takes a person far in the long term. And that person, yeah, I just can't see that person being, say, minimum 5 years, 10 years. I just couldn't imagine that person could be reborn as an animal or actually drop to the home realms, because the wholesome karma is just it's just too strong. But anyway, so were there any other questions before we finish up? Okay.